It always blows my mind when I see investors being willing to allocate 5, 10, even 15 to 20% to a single equity because they have conviction in it, yet they refuse to allocate just even half that space on a diversified trend following strategy, which itself is a basket of numerous assets that they otherwise would never own, but are low correlated to equities and are capable of delivering that crisis alpha when you need it.
Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com. Co-hosting with me, Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management. Mike, how you doing?
I'm well. Exciting guest today.
Yeah. Tony Dong is our guest. Tony is the founder of ETFPortfolioBlueprint.com, where he shares his latest independent, unvarnished ETF analysis, takes, and commentary as well on the Canadian and U.S. ETF marketplace and markets. Tony is also lead ETF analyst at ETF Central, where he contributes a timely stream of clear-eyed, no-nonsense analysis on ETFs.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Tony, welcome. It is great to have you on the show.
It's great to be back.
Tony, for the sake of those who don't yet know you, tell us about your career, how you got started, what inspired you into the world of ETFs and ETF analysis in the first place?
So I always credit it back to Warren Buffett and his number one rule, which was don't lose money. And I've kind of always been obsessed with that over my life, just thinking about all the ways to mitigate downside risk. And early on in my career, I used to work in corporate risk management for a Vancouver Public Transportation Authority. It was honestly a lot of paperwork, a lot of make work, a lot of box ticking. So, concurrently while I was doing that, I did a master's program from Columbia University on risk management, and that kind of got me introduced to practically how big financial institutions, identify, portion, and manage the risk, whether it be credit, operational, or strategic. And one of the courses dealt with, how to manage investment risk. And one of the tools that they introduced was exchange-traded funds. Now, I was already familiar with this, having invested in a few index ETFs, but prior to that course, I didn't know how sophisticated that they could become. And the more I learned about it, the more interested I was looking at the very sophisticated overlays for hedging or for speculation or for convexity that were being deployed in these once boring but now very exciting investment vehicles. And from there, I started doing some independent research and sharing my findings on social media, got kind of a following on Reddit. And I used that to launch into kind of like an independent analyst slash writing career. I have contracts with and media agencies like U.S. News and World Report, Benzinga, The Street, Kiplinger, and of course my collaboration with ETF Central, which is owned by TrackInsight in partnership with the New York Stock Exchange, and that's been going on for a few years now. So in total, I've been self-employed since I think March 2022. So we're just over 3 years now on that, and it's just been a very interesting experience. I've got the chance to meet with a lot of ETF issuers, attend a lot of events, and learn about the new products. And just, let Canadian U.S. investors know like how these can impact them. But I also have a fairly sizable advisor audience as well.
Tony, you've got a knack for calling things out as you see them, a kind of like a raw common sense that's really refreshing, where you take a why would you do that when you could do this approach in your analysis. What are some of your latest revelations or peeves, if I might say? What are you seeing?
Well, this one's interesting. It's probably going to cause a bit of controversy, but the majority of cover call ETFs are terrible because they follow an index. There are some things that can be systematically automated. I think stock selection is one of those that it's really hard to get alpha from in the large cap space because of how efficient index algorithms are. Even market cap weighting, as primitive as it is, there is an undeniable air of efficiency to it, given how low the turnover is and how low the costs are. So you minimize your headwinds. But for a cover call strategy, you see a lot of them will do something very mechanically, like some of the ones from Global X will sell an at-the-money covered call on 100% of the portfolio, always 1 month to expiry. They're basically taking all the variables that influence options premium pricing and just using just like mechanically setting into the exact same one without regard for market conditions, earnings reports. Doesn't matter if there's like a well-telegraphed Fed meeting coming up on the day that they roll their calls. They're going to do the exact same thing. So what you find is that a lot of these like systematic options, index-based ETFs, they will almost always lag the uncovered benchmarks, so to speak. They're leaving so much upside on the table by not considering changes in implied volatility, you know, not considering changes in the underlying, even Vega, like something that like I almost never think about when trading options is going to influence that because just of how mechanical it is. And what we find is that paradoxically in the derivative overlay space where they cover call ETF space, the active ETFs like JEPI, JEPI or DEVO, they tend to outperform on a total return and a risk-adjusted basis simply because they have more discretion when it comes to, say, selecting their strike prices, selecting their expiry, and they're not restricted to writing blanket on 100% of the portfolio with an index. They can pick specific securities. They can pick to go out of the money. They can, say, only write on 50% of the underlying. It's just one of those like niches where like there is still alpha that you can generate by using active management. And we see that in fixed income as well. But for large cap equities, not really.
Right. The challenge of outperforming the stock selection is difficult. So it leaves the investor looking for other opportunities to bring risk adjusted returns to the table. I tend to agree on the covered call writing side. And, you know, covered writing kind of works in flat, slightly up or slightly down markets, most opportunistically.
Absolutely.
If you covered right that whole portfolio, you're giving up, you're getting more income, but you know, you're selling that upside away on the whole portfolio. So I'm always of the mind as, you know, leave some of that, whatever industry or category that you're writing on, leave some of those stocks uncovered so that they can capture the upside. So for example, I think some of the stuff you talked about in your gold, and gold is a nice asset class, or gold stocks are a nice asset class to cover, right? Maybe you can jump into a little bit of that too.
Yeah, I think anything that tends to trade range bound and comes with high volatility is a great underlying for a buy right strategy. So, you know, obviously you can't do that with gold bullion because it's a physical asset. But, you know, a lot of the gold backed ETFs like GLD have a very liquid options chain with weekly expiries, and they have multiple strike prices. And, you know, for the amount of capital you're locking up, you can earn a substantial premium. And one thing that I like about buy right strategies with commodity ETFs is that it's easier to deploy with a trend following strategy. Just, you know, for those of you who have experience actively managed commodities, it's much easier to identify a trend in this segment of the market than it is for, say, large cap equities. At least in my opinion, it is. And it gives you a chance to produce income from what is normally a non-income producing asset. And that extends to gold miners as well. So, you know, ETFs that I like for these include GLD and for gold miners, GDX from VanEck. But again, I always bring it back to when you're doing a buy right strategy, you need to explicitly understand that you are trading future upside for an immediate premium, the pricing of which may or may not fairly compensate you. You're selling a form of insurance. And like as all insurance, the riskier it is, aka the more volatile it is, the higher your upfront premium is going to be. So if you're going to be doing buy right, my suggestion is always be opportunistic, like you mentioned, or delegate it to an active manager who is capable of being opportunistic, and they're not just blanket selling your upside every month at the same time, at the same strike across the entire portfolio.
Yeah, and you do see, just as you said, Tony, that sort of classic, if it's if the sector is in a good, strong uptrend, you'll often see the covered right portfolio underperforming substantially if they've done that.
Oh, absolutely.
Full covered right all the time. And so that, you know, it's a yin and yang there a bit.
I mean, Tony, besides, you know, obviously chasing yield on something that's 100% buy right, can you think of any reason why an investor would opt for that? I mean, is it just strictly the yield chasing, or is there some other tactical reason or strategic reason for wanting or finding that to be like a solution for a particular problem?
I find buy right strategies, especially, you know, like cover call writing, it's an implicit short vol bet. but it's not perfect. Now, if you think about when you sell that covered call and you earn that premium that decays over time, you're hoping for volatility to fall. Ideally, you sell into a high volatility event like earnings where the implied volatility asset is building, and then afterwards it collapses. And then in addition to the time decay, you earn a return from the gamma deflating. But there are, like, if you want to capture that short volatility premium, there are more direct products for doing so. Now, that brings you to the next problem, which is these are negatively skewed, like, risk and return payoffs. You'll get a lot of small victories, and then one bad day is going to absolutely wipe you out. It's happened in 2018 with Volmageddon, and, you know, we have new short VIX futures products on the market, and some of them are, like, hedged in one way or the other. For instance, SXVY from ProShares only has notional exposure of 50% of its portfolio to front month VIX futures, short, of course. And SVIX has a out of the money VIX called as a hedge instead of reducing their exposure. But none of these are perfect, and these are still going to see sharp losses as they did recently when, volatility spikes. They're not perfectly correlated inversely to spot VIX either, because again, they hold, you know, front month futures, and that's going to depend more on the shape of the futures curve, if it's a contango or backwardation. So unfortunately, I do have to, like, make the assertion that most buy right strategies are for income seeking investors, and some will be more tax efficient than others. You know, the good ones will use tax loss harvesting and I forgot what the name of them are, some specific type of contract where they're able to pay out most of their distributions as return of capital. And as you know, that reduces your adjusted cost basis until it hits zero. And just, it's very rare to find one that outperforms the index on a risk-adjusted basis, and almost impossible on a total return basis. So they can reduce risk and produce better, better Sharpe ratios. But again, a lot of survivorship bias at play, and on a tax equivalent basis, even less so.
I'm curious in terms of, you know, if there's a material, like if over time, like for example, you know, the covered call queues, 100% covered call queues that you wrote about, is there a scenario, is there a use for, aside from, you know, maximizing yield at 12% plus, why would an investor, other than a retiree, let's say, who's chasing more income from their investments, why would somebody opt for this option, like where you're going to get maximum income, but over time, is it sort of equivalent to a decumulation strategy? Or
no, it's honestly totally illogical. Like I did the back test here, where if you from December 12th, 2013 to April 11th, 2025, you had two portfolios. One is QYLD, which is the Global X buy right strategy of the NASDAQ 100. It covers 100% of the portfolio with the overlay. It sells at the money, 1 month expiry. The second portfolio, you have the uncovered QQQ from Invesco and 50% in T-bills, risk-free treasury bills. Now, the second portfolio would have still come out ahead. And if you needed to do that decumulation, if you needed that income, you could have just sold shares and just done that at the long-term or short-term capital gains rate. You would have still come out ahead without sacrificing upside. And I think is that a lot of retail, like, to be quite frank, they don't understand the concept of total returns. They don't understand that a 12% yield is useless when all of it is what we call destructive return of capital. You know, return of capital that where literally is your money coming back to you. And QYLD in its like distribution disclaimers actually says this. You know, I'm reading it right here. QYLD currently estimates it has distributed more than its income and net realized gains. Therefore, a portion of your distribution may be return of capital. For March 2025, it was 97.15%. Return of capital. There's no scenario where I would pay Global X 60 basis points a year to cap my upside, retain full downside participation, underperform a 50-50 portfolio of the NASDAQ 100 and T-bills, and get 97% of the distribution back every month as my own money, right? It's just, but you see, they don't look past these details. All they see is that this ETF has paid monthly distributions for 12 years running nonstop, and it yields 12% right now. And yet there is a scenario where QYLD will probably outperform. It's called the lost decade. If we see something from 1999 to 2009 where the U.S. market returns negative on a real basis, yeah, this buy right strategy will probably do quite well, because I'm betting it's going to be volatile the entire time if it stays range bound. And, you know, every single month those strikes and those expiries pay off, great. But it's like, you're stretching here, you know? It's much more likely that the scenario is going to be something else.
Yeah, and I think it's also, remember, these are tools for investors to use. So if for example, there wasn't a NASDAQ covered writing portfolio where they had a little bit more discretion, maybe they were writing a portion of the portfolio rather than the whole portfolio. If that didn't exist, the investor can create that sort of thing, saying, okay, well, I want to hold the NASDAQ. I want to hold it naked, but I also want to covered write it. So I think I'm going to hold 70% in the NASDAQ and I'm going to hold 30% covered written.
Yep.
And then maybe you sit and think through, okay, well, I'll throw a trend following overlay on it. And when I'm below the 200-day, I'm going to write 50% of the index. And when I'm above the 200-day, I'm going to write 20%. And so you, again, it's always thinking incrementally. These are not all or none decisions. You've got lots of tools laid out in front of you to accomplish your goals. And thinking through that, I think I've heard you, Tony, talk about the investment policy statement too. What I'm outlining are some guidelines in an investment policy statement that you might create some rules ahead of time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're in the foxhole and the bullets are flying, you know, everybody believes in Jesus at that moment. You got to have a plan, you got to have things to do, but it's a hard time to make decisions. So if you've thought through things beforehand, and then you're faced with some sort of bear market or some volatility in the markets, you go back and refer to your plan. What was I supposed to do here? Oh yeah, the NASDAQ is below the 200-day. I'm supposed to be actually writing 50% of my portfolio. Let me make some adjustments to that. So these are tools for investors to use, and there's certainly a lot of them now, every day coming out with more and more interesting and different products.
Yeah, people BYLD, because it's big, you know, it's got like a few billion assets under management. It's one of GlobalX's biggest ETFs, and they know it. It's a big moneymaker for them, you know, with a couple billion and 60 basis point expense ratio, they're making good money on this. There's not a lot of incentives to search outward, but, you know, off the top of my head, I can name three other buy right ETFs on the NASDAQ that have beat this thing and are also much cheaper. JEPQ, QQQI. Like you said, diversify your diversifiers, right? There is a time and place to use something like QILD, but if you don't have the system in place and like the written statements for, you know, when you're going to deploy this, when you're going to rotate into it, when and how you're going to cut losses, it's a crapshoot.
Yeah, I would, you know, to both your points, it makes sense if you do not view these ETFs as standalone investments, but rather as like not in isolation, but rather, as Mike, as you put it, as tools, as some part of a tactical strategy where you're using it the way it's meant to be used, as opposed to just saying, I'm going to invest in, you know, QYLD and get paid. You know, it's not about that. It's about using it as a proper diversification tool. So maybe you view it as an alternative. And like a lot of alternatives, you don't want to necessarily view this as a standalone investment, but as part of a portfolio construction.
I think, you know, if I was to use something like QYLD, I would do exactly what you mentioned, is that, you know, use the 200-day simple moving average. When it crosses below, you rotate from, say, uncapped into QYLD, but maybe you only do it when, you know, the VIX is also high, so the premiums, you know, are above average, something like that, right? And funny enough, there are ETFs that do that. Off the top of my head, PTNQ from Pacer. It's a 200-day simple moving average rotation strategy between the NASDAQ 100 and T-bills. And yeah, it does cut your downside risk, but, you know, unfortunately, it kind of launched at a poor time, right around COVID. And, you know, during that like V-shaped recovery, it kind of got whipsawed. And it not only did it, you know, it capped the downside, but it completely missed the upside recovery because it just went right back through the trend line, and they couldn't rotate the portfolio fast enough. So there's downsides to everything, but what I keep coming back to is diversify your diversifiers. And I think we can all agree on that, is that, you know, just stocks and bonds aren't enough anymore.
That seems to be really the case as we move into this period of potentially some sort of stagflation, right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, you've got bonds and stocks that sort of become correlated, and as we saw in 2022, and bonds really have been lackluster as a diversifier through the recent period as well. So obviously gold is starting to come to the forefront as a classic primary diversifier to, you know, the whether it's the bond malaise, printing of money, geopolitical crisis, all the things that are going on at the moment are certainly putting gold into a pretty decent trend. Probably the only asset class that really has, you know, classic all three moving averages moving up simultaneously underneath and the price above those three moving averages, notwithstanding any short-term pullback. But again, you know, even on the upside, there's an interesting thought. You know, would you on the upside say, okay, well, it's getting frothy here. Maybe I sell a little bit of my GLD and I'll buy something that writes GLD or GDX. I'm going to sell something,
yeah,
buy a right here, to just have some hedge at what might be a bit of a correction. Again, that gets pretty active though. I mean, you know, most of the time investors are probably best, you know, just generally hands off.
But, yeah, just rebalance and get gold allocation periodically. But you're right. It's a buy right strategy. I think a buy right strategy in gold makes sense right now because, there's no idea how long the momentum will run on. And, you know, one of my sayings is if it's good enough to screenshot, it's good enough to sell. And I look at buy right strategies on volatile trending assets like gold as basically a way to get paid to set a limit sell. You know, and it's the same with Bitcoin. Yeah, there's an argument that you don't want to cap your upside there. But when we're kind of at this point in the bull run, you know, it's, you should be looking at taking some profits, right? And that's, I'm a bit more of a risk averse guy, but that's what I do. Structurally, I love gold. You know, I get it doesn't produce cash flows like stocks or bonds, but it's one of the few investable assets with a persistently low correlation to both. It's not tied to corporate earnings or government creditworthiness. It can't be debased, printed, or duplicated. So, you know, when trust in fiat currency and financial systems break down, that's it. And, you know, that's, I'm a bit of a bond skeptic too. There's just, for instance, my argument against long-term treasuries is why would I ever want to lend the U.S. government money for 20 years? If I can't find an answer to that, that's why we'll never touch something like TLT, even though, yeah, there's an argument that there is a convexity and flight to safety play there should long-term rates fall during a recession. But, you know, I think that if you want to hedge, there are better ways than relying on finicky historical correlations. And if you must rely on correlations, have a couple of them. Have a basket where they all offset each other and then leverage that up to get to wherever you want to be, you know?
Sounds a lot like risk parity right there.
I love risk parity.
Well, and that's a great segue. That's a great segue, guys. I Tony, you recently wrote about three ETFs that could outperform in a volatile tariff-driven market environment. That's a big question these days. There's some really interesting ideas in there, including the one Mike just mentioned. Can we dive into that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, well, when I think about tariffs, it's the classic, I call it the macroeconomic Schrodinger's-like question, is that it creates a policy environment where the two levers the Fed traditionally has to fulfill its dual mandate of max employment and steady price increases are directly at conflict with each other. Tariffs absolutely wreck demand. Yet if you push the money printer button, inflation is going to go up with it. But if you try and lower rates too, it's going to do the same thing. It's a scenario where you don't know how long this is going to last. We think it's going to be for 4 years. But again, like Trump has already shown us that our conventional way of thinking about how to approach these problems is not working anymore because we are working with somebody who does not operate on those same principles, right? It's a crapshoot. So, you know, I'm always for maximum diversification here. The problem is your average portfolio, you know, barring leverage, can only have 100% of all these assets. So if you allocate between, you know, the four designed for different economic conditions, inflation protected securities, nominal bonds, global equities, and commodities, at most, you can only have 25% of each in a portfolio. On a risk parity basis, the allocations are going to be even different. So the solution to get around that is leverage. And the thing is, for institutional investors, leverage is easy to come by. If you're a pension fund officer, you probably already know this is capital efficient investing. For retail, it's a lot harder. I don't think your average investor is well equipped to manage margin, and it's actually quite destructive for the average investor. So, you know, when you hand it off to an ETF manager like State Street or Resolve, they're able to use their sophistication to use derivative overlays like swaps and futures that provide that embedded leverage while still keeping it in a very liquid ETF structure. And I think that's been the real dark horse in the ETF industry, seeing these capital efficient strategies, you know, like what modern portfolio theory has been telling us all along. You take a basket of volatile, uncorrelated assets, each of which is sensitive and resistant to different economic conditions and drivers. You balance them according to their contribution to risk, and then you just simply apply leverage until you get your desired risk in return. And the fact that it all comes in an exchange-traded vehicle with a bid and an ask that doesn't go above its net asset value or below too often, I think that's kind of the holy grail of what we've been looking for advisors and retail.
That's a hell of a soundbite. I love that.
The key there in what Tony's saying, into my mind, is it's leverage for diversification, right? You're not more cowbell, as they say, right? It's not double the S&P, as it were, but it's taking something that is a diversifier to the portfolio and layering it. We call it return stacking, obviously. Layering that on top of your beta, whatever that might be, your stock beta, your bond beta. Oftentimes, if you're talking about the true diversifiers that will work in a growth shock type environment, that's an interesting one to stack actually on your bonds rather than on your stocks, which is interesting because your bonds, you know, if you get into a stock bear market and you're stocking on the S&P and the S&P goes down by 50%, well, hopefully the stack on top is going up and neutralizing that a little bit. But again, that as a stack, it's contracting. Whereas if you were stacking it on bonds and bonds were a little bit more resilient or potentially even going up, your hedge would be actually enhancing some of that side of your portfolio. There's yings and yangs to both sides of that, obviously. Mm-hmm. Stack on both as well is a great idea. But coming back to your key point, Tony, it's adding that leverage to build the diversification.
Yeah,
that's key, right? It's the non-correlated returns that you're trying to stack so that as you put them together, you actually A plus B has lower volatility than actually A and B.
Absolutely. It's just simple covariance. And you know, the dumbest thing, I think, is when people take a portfolio of 100% equities and then decide that the next logical step is to leverage that up 1.5 times. You're just betting extra market beta and you're not compensated more for that. And when you factor in the cost of borrowing and, you know, rebalancing drag, you know, the risk adjusted returns are poor. You look at any leverage ETS long-term returns and ignoring the daily reset, it's always significantly worse after the expenses and the leverage and the difference between the geometric and the arithmetic mean. If you don't have a negatively correlated asset to rebalance between, the risk adjusted returns are almost worse. I'm telling people, like, you don't get the full effects of the leverage as you think you would on paper. It's not 2 times what you're doing. It's 2 times minus the cost of those embedded swaps, minus the expense ratio, and minus the daily drag from the volatility, right? It's imperfect. And I think the more people that understand this, the more people will be able to get better risk-adjusted returns. But, you know, there's always a gap between investor understanding and what they have access to. And I think these new, like, you know, these return stack products really do fill that gap. The question is, how can we educate outside of advisors to make them aware of this? Because most people glaze over when I talk about the efficient frontier.
Yeah, I would say that's been our experience as well, is that a professional advisor here is very helpful in really kind of understanding the mathematics around an efficient frontier and all the nuance, right? The 70s, the efficient frontier was a straight line because stocks in a stock bond context.
Yeah.
From the standpoint of an efficient frontier. In the 70s, stagflationary environment, both rates are going up while you're having a growth shock. The efficient frontier was a straight line. And that just means if you added bonds, you just had less risk. There was none of that curve that occurred that says, well, for this risk, you can actually get much more return. And so that's another funny covariance thing that can happen within asset classes that we were referring to earlier with sort of bonds being a questionable, maybe a less certain diversifier than we've had since 1982.
If you're trying to beat the market, if you consider that a fight to beat the market, trying to take down the market with more market, it might just work. It might just work, but not necessarily not the way you want it to. You
know? If you fan a fire, it'll eventually burn out, but not before torching you. You know, like it's gonna get pretty bad. People forget that during the Volcker era, we had double-digit interest rates, and a lot of the assumptions we had about asset allocation at the time completely went out the window. And we just saw a mini version of that in 2022. So, you know, like every time I see a back test that shows like, oh, you should have, you should always have 10%, 20% in long-term treasuries. I'm like, you data fitted this through a 2-decade long falling rate, almost zero in, like, it's almost zero real rate environment. Like there's nothing you can extrapolate from this. It is driving using the rear view window to the best. And you know, I've seen this taken to the extremes online with something you might be familiar with. It's called Hedge Fundy's Excellent Adventure. It's one of the most degenerate things I've seen out of the Bogleheads form of all. They take 55% in UPRO, which is a 3x leveraged pro shares S&P 500 ETF, and 45% in TMF, which is a directions 3x leveraged 20-year treasury. So you have approximately 60 years of duration on the bond side, no credit risk though. And on the equity side, you have a very crude way of leveraging large cap US equities. And apparently, you know, it's a 60-40 portfolio, stretch the extreme, you leverage it 3x. And yeah, when they did the back test prior to 2022, and coincidentally, this is when retail really caught on to this strategy, it looked fantastic. You know, you're getting like 22% annualized returns, better risk-adjusted return than just the S&P 500. It was like the holy grail. And then, as we know, 2022 happened, and this thing drew down by like 80%, and you know, the rest is history. But yeah, it's when you leave retail alone with complex derivative-based exchange-traded products that they don't fully understand, and you give them access to like back test tools, they come up with some truly interesting things. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because I like to think that some ETF issuers looked at that as a case study and, you know, improved upon it, as I suspect Resolve did. But there's a ton of casualties to learn from if you look carefully.
And so, Tony, what do you think about when you think through the diversification? And in the current context with portfolios today, with sort of our lack of trust in the bond market, what are your thoughts there? How does an investor maintain some diversification in the portfolio? Do they opt to just be a little bit more cash, really short term in their bonds? How do you think through that?
I love options overlays. You know, I know it's a zero sum game, but it is one of the only ways that you can get defined, mathematically guaranteed protection, barring a clearinghouse failure or CME, like losing power. You know, so something I like to do when I say go on vacation is a put spread caller. So if I have a long position in the S&P 500, I will buy, say, a 5% out of the money put. So my downside protection begins at 5% below the current price of the S&P 500. To finance that, I will then sell a 20% out of the money put. So unfortunately, after a 20% drawdown, I will resume participating in losses. But my losses for that 5 to 20% interval are buffer. And that's just because the majority of these drawdowns, aside from like the really bad ones, tend to be within that range. And I'm willing to take the chance that, you know, when I'm going on vacation, any kind of volatility that I can't respond to will probably be in that range. Unfortunately, the sold put doesn't cover the cost of the purchase put, so I also have to cap my upside, and that's usually with an out-of-the-money call, around 4 to 5% out-of-the-money. And that pretty much creates a collar, but, you know, not like the traditional call you think of, because my gains are capped at there, and my losses are only capped after the first 5% and not beyond the extra 20, right? And of course, you're able to like adjust that. For instance, I can get rid of that sold put and just cap my losses at 5%. But then that would require me to move my short call strike down to pretty much at the money. So it completely kills my upside. But you see here is that, you know, with a good options calculator, and there's plenty of these online, you can precisely define the parameters of what you want your protection and your gains to be over a certain period. And that's what I like about it. It's just having that certainty. Unfortunately, this is by retail standards, this is a fairly sophisticated strategy, and not everybody is able to do it, especially if you're an account where you can't sell puts, right? A couple of registered accounts come to mind. But they're, you know, what I'm describing is widely available with buffer ETO. Again, this isn't a thing where I would say, okay, this is enough. It's you can't just rely on these products as their own, because again, they're derivative based. A lot of them are relatively untested. And of course, as any structured products are, it's issuer dependent, right? You don't know how good the execution is going to be. Some of them use flex options. Some of them use, I think they're called 1260 contracts. It all depends. So again, it's just another component of your toolbox to consider when, you know, you don't want to rely on correlations, or you're managed to buy one at the start of an outcome period, and you understand how the buffer is measured and how to decide, you know, how much you have left, how much upside you have, and, you know, just learning how to interpret the payoff profile of these things is, I would say, it's an advisor tool.
Yeah, interesting. That's a good point, especially the vacation. Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Oh yeah, I love callers.
The split spread.
Yeah, the degree you sell, you know, caller, just leave it alone.
Yep.
I got something interesting to share about the put spread caller. You know, in 2012, we published a post called The Put Spread Caller. And that post gets 2,500 to 5,000 hits every month.
Wow.
Since that one article, for us, it's like a magical, you know, thing that we never understood why, but you mentioned spread caller, and that's immediately what I thought about, was the fact that we've got this post that has been on the site for, 13 years?
Yeah.
And it has consistently been a leading traffic driver from search to advisor analyst.
I just saw it right now, yeah, by Randy Frederick from 2012. It's a sign of a client. But I think it just speaks that, you know, investors, advisors especially, they're sick of relying on correlations, you know, and if, you know, backtesting correlations is, again, driving using a rearview mirror. Forecasting correlations brings you all the downsides of forecasting with the quantitative rigor that is required. And to be quite frank, not everybody has it. And that's okay. Like, I don't. I consider myself a pretty quantitatively driven guy, and I don't want to be modeling this stuff, right? So callers are just a very defined way of using the tools readily available to you. In this case, exchange-traded options, or if you want to get fancy, flex options, if you want to customize the payoff. And yeah, there's an infinite amount of permutations you can deploy with these.
What do you think is an option from the standpoint of, okay, so I can't trust my bonds as much, so I'm gonna maybe overweight equities, but I'll overweight the equities maybe using a low vol or a min vol process in order to maybe take the equities a native volatility down in my portfolio, have less bonds, but knowing that, you know, my stocks are actually a little bit less volatile than the market beta. What are your thoughts there? Do you have preferences between low vol versus min vol?
I don't like either. A low vol is, you see how low vol is traditionally deployed, where, for instance, the S&P 500 low vol index, every quarter it reconstitutes by selecting the 100 securities from the S&P 500 with the lowest realized volatility over the past 12 months. You get a static basket of defensive names overweighted to, you know, the three typical sectors: healthcare, consumer staples, and utilities. The problem is, A, you're taking an uncompensated sector bet. And there's a lot to dislike about, say, utilities, where I would argue it's not a safe sector at all anymore. Interest rate risk is massive there, given how much debt most of these are. You think about how the typical utility grows. They can either increase their rate base by expanding services, that requires them to take on CapEx by building like new generation facilities that won't pay off until quite a bit, or they can raise their rates, much of which is contractually regulated, so it's capped. So your upside's already capped. But the downside is a lot of these are regionally concentrated, so one bad environmental incident will wipe them out. Think about PG&E or Edison in California after the wildfires, or a couple of the Florida ones. So again, uncompensated sector risk. And with healthcare, you know, with all that healthcare insurance in there, with all that regulatory shocks, like with United Health, it's just, I don't think the traditional defensive sectors are much defensive anymore. I'll make an exception for consumer staples because the inelastic demand really is there. And the margins of most of these, aside from the retailers, are just, they're enough to just withstand a lot of stuff. So that's why I don't like low vol. Min vol, on the other hand, again, relies on that very complex correlation matrix. Yeah, they tend to be more sector neutral, but they're using quantitative frameworks that in the aggregate considers the correlation between holdings. And it's basically like you combine a bunch of spicy ingredients and hope that the resulting concoction is not as spicy. Now, again, that all depends on which ingredients you pick and how they interact. And unfortunately, when it comes to these more sophisticated indexes, I am very wary of leaving it hands off. Like, it's just, there's no way they've like considered all possible constraints and variables when going into it. And chances are it's very much streamlined and like slimmed down. And, you know, the backtest shows that, yeah, the min vol approach has outperformed the low vol. But when you look at their maximum drawdowns during like what I call a quote unquote, all correlations go to one event like COVID, the drawdowns are just as bad as a broad market equity index with a beta of one. You know, even though both of these solutions have lower beta 0.73 around, during these like what I call oh crap moments, they still fall just as much. So you do need something. And like more and more I'm finding, given what's available, is that trend following is number one for what I'm doing right now. Just you don't have to make a central to your portfolio, but like make some room for it. You know, if you're already comfortable allocating to broad commodities and gold, take the next step and use a trend following approach, because these markets do form discernible trends and reversals. And with how cheap and liquid they are in ETFs today, you don't have to be a, you don't have to like do the work of a CTA yourself. You can easily delegate it.
Yeah. And you know, when trend following is an interesting one as well, it's had a bit of a rough go over the last little while. And it's, you know, it's a function of what are you trend following? How many assets is it? 5, 50, and all the machinations that come with tracking all of that. But you know, the simple 200 day can do a lot for you in the 50 day. But
for trend following, you know, my advice to listeners is to buy the shop, not the ETF, or you know, buy the shop behind it. It really matters here, because not all CTAs will, you know, define, you know, their constraints for what qualifies as a trend or even their investable universe. For instance, some CTA funds will include equity futures. And I don't like that, because if your goal is to diversify from equity risk, well, why would you have equity futures in there? I would rather much see trend following as a diversifier across the major commodities markets. So for precious metals, energy and agriculture futures, I love it when it comes to currencies, because that's an often ignored risk premium that you can easily get nowadays, especially with how liquid currency futures are. You get all the major pairs and then you mitigate a significant source of volatility. And finally, bond market futures. So not just the treasury, look at the gilt too, look at Australian, look at Canadian, look at the yen, Japanese bonds, sovereign bonds from developed nations. So, and again, you can all combine this in a basket, but again, it's by the manager, right? So someone with a demonstrated track record of innovating in this space, of trying new things in the ETF wrapper. Very much props to those who took the risk of bringing these two ETFs, because it's honestly been a long time coming, especially in Canada.
Agreed. Amen. And yeah.
Preaching to the choir.
We approach trend in a couple of ways, but you know, there's from the perspective of a replication process, you can replicate or you can build it yourself across all of those various assets. I think we've got like 65 to 75 in some of the products. But
yeah, I think a lot of the misconception against trend is that they think that there is a manager like actually staring at candlesticks and going, in reality, it's a very quantitatively driven model.
Extremely.
It's incredibly hands off. And I like it because it's as objective as you can get with a buy high and sell higher, or avoid selling low and avoid buying low strategy. You know, it's a lot of the concept that retail intuitively gets, but they don't know how to deploy, is being used here.
Yeah. And I think that part of the challenge can be at times intuition that the investor might have around what trend following is, especially when it's on a bunch of assets that might be a little bit esoteric to them. But it is a you know, investors do have to build a bit of intuition in that over time as they deploy these types of strategies and be patient. And I think if an investor is thinking through that and it's their first time, go slow, start slow, so that whatever you're adding to your portfolio, you can actually stick with, right? So think through, I'm going to add this new thing. I'm going to add some sort of trend following layer on top of my portfolio. Okay, great. Let's not get you to the 20 or 30% that might be an institutional program right away. Let's start with 2 or 3 or 4. Let you go through a couple cycles, both the up, you know, hey, we're, you know, in the penthouse and in the outhouse, because every strategy will have those moments. And then get your comfort with how that interacts with your portfolio, how it adds value. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of ways for investors to really experience that except to experience it.
Yeah.
And then kind of feel how their investment tolerances react to it. And so as you layer on these newer products, we've talked about a lot of cutting edge stuff, just go slow, give yourself some time, be patient with yourself. And just think about, well, if this went down by X, 25%, would I still be able to hold it? And if that 25% is a dollar value, right? So it goes down by 25% and it's 25% of my total portfolio. That's going to be rough.
Oh, yeah.
It was down by 25%, but it's 1% of my whole portfolio. You're probably going to glide through that pretty easily. You're going to experience that. You're going to internalize that. It's going to recover. And you're not going to make the mistake that most investors do, which is selling a strategy or an asset class or a premium at its drawdown, crystallizing the loss and not giving yourself the opportunity to gain the returns, the excess returns that come from that strategy if you're just patient.
Yeah, a lot of the benefit of these can only be realized if you're rebalancing within your portfolio in a disciplined manner. It always blows my mind when I see investors being willing to allocate 5, 10, even 15 to 20% to a single equity because they have conviction in it, yet they refuse to allocate just even half that space on a diversified trend following strategy, which itself is a basket of numerous assets that they otherwise would never own, but are low correlated to equities and are capable of delivering that crisis alpha when you need it. And the hardest part about realizing crisis alpha is actually just waiting for the bloody crisis to occur. It's that urge to do something that is just so hard to get rid of. But, you know, again, investment policy statement, just hold your alternatives, stay the course, right? And don't be that statistic where it shows that a lot of the outflows from these come during bull markets and the inflows comes during the bear markets after a lot of that crisis alpha has already been generated, you know?
The masses do sell the bottoms of
buy. Oh, it's crazy. I've been looking at the inflows over like the last month, and it's like perfectly timed during that trough when everybody was saying sell, sell, sell. People were flying into like TLT, the Alpha Architects, you know, their tail risk ETF chaos. People were fleeing into that, and they were leaving like beta. So a lot of exit is out of large cap growth. And right now, we're seeing the same thing reverse. I'm looking at it ahead of the Fed decision, and it's just... they consistently get the timing wrong. And what they forget is that these tools, yeah, they're like the model used within is tactical, but their use within a portfolio is strategic.
Yes, that's well said.
Yeah.
Very well said. The allocation is strategic. Internally, it's going to be acting very tactically. And that's what you want. And you need to stay the course. So always think through how, if I make this allocation, can I live with it at its worst? At its best, you don't need to worry about it. You're probably going to try and add to it at its best. I don't know what to tell you there. Just rebalance. And this is the other thing, right? Tony mentioned earlier the rebalance drag that comes from a double ETF, double exposure to the same index like stocks ETF. That's actually a rebalancing tailwind if you've got non-correlated strategies.
Absolutely.
And so you can pay for all of your fees by simply rebalancing your portfolio.
There is tangible premium to be realized there if you do it in a disciplined and consistent manner. So you either, like I said, I think the simplest for most people to do is just first trading day of each quarter, just do that first trading day of each month. Some people do rebalancing bands, but the more you tinker and the more you overthink it, the more room for error you have. There is a perfect way of rebalancing. No, nobody's figured it out yet. And a lot of people have blown themselves up trying to get there. You know, at some point, if it's good enough, just leave it alone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Rob Arnott uses the phrase sin a little, right? Mm-hmm. So if you've got something in your portfolio that's creeped up and it's overweight, maybe, again, if you add in your IPS statement, I started with 10%, I'm going to rebalance, but if it's at 15, I'm going to bring the rebalance back to 12, not 10. But do some rebalancing. But sin a little is what he says. and I want to emphasize emphasize Tony's point on rebalancing. It is choices around preferences. The combination and the dimensionality of the multiple assets moving together has a lot of different outcomes and a lot of different things that can work better or worse based on how you might be rebalancing today, rebalancing luck. And so it's going to look really good at sometimes. It's going to look kind of mad sometimes, you know. Think about you own Bitcoin and it just goes up all the time and you're constantly selling it as it goes up. You're putting it into other assets. So, you know, it will feel like you're underperforming Bitcoin, but your portfolio as a whole is probably doing very, very well.
Yeah.
And you're managing the risk, right? You're going to let Bitcoin get to 20% and all of a sudden you got an asset class that has an 80 volatility, which is five times that of stocks. It's 20% of your portfolio. That means your portfolio's risk is largely Bitcoin with a 20% position.
That's my problem with the traditional 60-40 too. 90% of the risk is still driven by the stock side.
Stocks, exactly.
Yeah. But people, the other way when people ask me, they're like, you really need to diversify. I'm like, think about the worst day that you've ever encountered investing. Wouldn't it be nice to have at least one asset that's in the green? And, you know, for most investors, that'd probably be a little bit of cash. But you don't want to like take that chance because inflation is also a thing. So like have a couple things sitting in there that even on your worst day where you feel like capitulating, you can look at it and say, well, at least my trend following ETF is in the green. At least my broad treasury ETF is in the green. I don't think anybody would seriously go long vol via an ETF for the long term. But, you know, if you have like a tail risk protection there, sure. On that, it's just such a crapshoot to hedge that I don't even bother anymore.
Yeah. How do you get investors to do that before the day arrives?
I do it in my newsletter by highlighting stories of those who have blown out precisely by not doing it. No shortage of examples. I'm not just talking like people who like, you know, like buy a zero DTE SPX call before like CPI drops or something like that. That's just financial Darwinism. But, you know, people who like are very much average Joes, but, you know, they fell for what I call the index tracker and chill meme, which I don't think I can explain any better. Your average person is not mentally equipped for 100% equity allocation. They are simply not. The average person after the 2020 like QE environment is under the assumption that stocks only go up aside from maybe one bad year of like a 20% drawdown. In reality, we've seen it gone down significantly more, and there's a treasure trove of stuff. I love using a case study from Bogleheads where it was this there was this poster named Sheepdog, and they had a pretty good diversified portfolio, but they sold at the bottom of 2008. You could see all their posts where they were anguished about it. All the other members are trying to comfort them, but there were serious doubts among a community of what are supposedly stay the course, John Bogle loving, you know, by VTI and chill investors who, you know, normally are full of like somewhat cultish, but good advice, I'll have to admit. But these people were panic selling like any other, right? And this is typically what I consider to be like the best of the DIY retail space. And they were capitulating. Because it is very different to look at a backtest and say that I can tolerate a 50% drawdown. It is different when you have a portfolio of at least six figures. And a 50% drawdown means you lost $50,000, basically a year's salary in a couple of days for some people. Right? That is a freaking scary feeling. And if you don't know that it's going to come back because everybody's saying that it's the end of American capitalism and there's bankers on the streets with their cardboard boxes, well, their knickknacks from Lehman Brothers stuffed in there crying. And Cramer is yelling that Bernanke needs to lower rates. It is one of those moments that like really tests your resolve and like no pun intended actually. And just having, I think just having that one asset in the green, whether it be an emergency fund at the very simplest or a trend following strategy that is delivering crisis alpha, invaluable, right? Yeah. It just takes that one moment to convert someone for life. And, you know, that's kind of how I like felt during COVID.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the buffered ETFs as well. They can play a role in that. It's, you know, especially when you're sort of in the making new highs area. And you get far away from potential support levels, you know, it becomes difficult then because, you know, someone sees the money in their statement at the end of the month, they view that as their money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Panto accounts. So, they bucket it.
Yeah. As soon as that comes in, that's the new level. There's no compensation for the fact that these assets do have normal natural volatility that goes up and down.
Yeah.
And like you say, Tony, we've seen it before. You know, I was there in 2000. I saw that happen. I saw that changed from, you know, tech stocks to gold out the door and oil out the door, $200 gold, $9 oil. And then to watch from 2000 to 2008, that change to a BRIC focus. Everyone in the U.S. was focused on international diversification. The BRICs were a thing. Commodities were a must-have. Gold had to be had. And then, you know, you get to a position in 2011 and going forward, you get U.S. dominance. You get a low inflation, high growth world, a software boom. And all of a sudden now we're sitting 14 years later and the collective memory of all of the investors is...
There's fighting and last battle again.
Yeah.
You know, I have no idea how long this Mag 7 dominance will end. All I know is that there is no scenario in hell where I will pay 100 times earnings for Palantir while the company continues to, like, pay its employees with stock-based compensation. You know, it doesn't take a genius to understand that, you know, it doesn't matter if these companies are the future of innovation or there it's a new tech paradigm. If you pay too much per dollar of earnings any enterprise generates, your future returns are going to be poor. That's just the reality. That's just how the time value of money works. And a lot of people just fail to understand that when they invest in something.
They are great companies. They just might not be great stocks right now.
Oh, yeah. A great company, an asset can absolutely be a great investment and paradoxically be a terrible buy at the time. It's one of those things where I love using the example with home builders and the peak earnings trap. You know, when a lot of the times when these stocks look cheap, they are in fact very expensive because they're so cyclical that they are in the trough of that cycle. You know, and conversely, when they're looking expensive on a price to earnings basis, they are actually cheap because they're at the peak of that cycle. You see it a lot in cyclical industries, and investors often get jaded by that. I see it in energy too, where they say, like, oh, well, you know, ExxonMobil is trading at 12 times earnings. Oh, I'm like, it's at the trough of the cycle. You buy it now, oil price, you know, you're catching a falling knife. And you know, I don't really own a lot of individual stocks aside from a few, but it's when you consider how many variables you have to consider to fully go long on a single position, I think at most I can only have like four or five individual positions. And that's just because I read a study out there that says if you really want to add alpha through stock picking, you got to have two things: low turnover and high active share. And it's typically a combination of both. There's a very good unit investment trust out there called the Voya Trust. I think it's been around since like the early 1900s. It had a static portfolio as a UIT. It's not able to change. And over time, through mergers, bankruptcies, spinoffs, and so forth, it's been whittled down to, say, 25 companies. But it smokes the market. They just didn't do anything. They never rebalanced it or anything. All they did was just add new money and meet redemptions, but they never made any active portfolio decisions. But they kept a very concentrated portfolio that was different from the benchmark and didn't touch it. And it outperformed the S&P 500. So I tend to think back to that whenever I consider, you know, buying a company that I saw that maybe, you know, I want to own, but chances are most of the time the best action is inaction.
Yeah, that old study where they went back, I don't know if it was Fidelity or Schwab, then it was the best performing accounts were those that were people who were dead. Forgot they had the account.
Yeah. Amazing. One last thing, Tony. It's been such a great discussion so far. I'm curious about Switzerland. You wrote about Switzerland in ETF Central and what are your thoughts on that? It's something that's outside of, you know, our mindset here in North America. We're not really thinking about Switzerland, not necessarily, but so what's the lowdown on investing in Switzerland?
It really is, and this is, you know, where I'm going to put on my my global macro hat and try to do a very crude approximation of what a Ray Dalio does. But there are a number of variables that I think make Switzerland a structurally attractive equity market in the event of geopolitical volatility. We are, for lack of a better term, entering a very polarized world. There are three wars going on right now. There's one in the European front, there's one in the Middle Eastern front, and now we have one in the Southeast Asian front. You know, I don't want to be like fear-mongering here, but there kind of is like a very defined axis and allied side in the 21st century. I'm not going to say who's who, but you guys can probably figure it yourself. The one variable that has remained consistent through all this were the two. One of them has been gold's utility. The other one has been the neutrality and the relative stability of Switzerland. For instance, a lot of people don't know the Swiss benchmark interest rate, their policy interest rate, is at 0.25 because the country just does not deal with inflation. They have their own currency. They're in Europe, but they are not part of the EU or NATO. So there's no Article 4, like mutual defense clause, that's going to drag them into a broader European conflict. They have an incredibly strong healthcare industry thanks to its dominant pharmaceutical sector. The financial robustness of UBS, not Credit Suisse, but UBS and also Zurich Reinsurance is very good. And it is underallocated within European ETFs. You know, it might not look like it because it's about 15% of Europe, but some European ETFs don't include Eurozone. Some of them are only EU members. So it's not really something to consider. And what people don't realize is now it's cheaper than ever to allocate to Switzerland, right? For a long time, your go-to option since 1996 actually was the iShares MSCI Switzerland ETF at 50 basis points. It's quite expensive. But, you know, like Franklin Templeton, they've released the Franklin FTSE Switzerland ETF and FLSW charges 9 basis points. You can invest in one of the best developed international markets for 9 basis points a year. You put 10 grand into that, that's a $9 annual fee drag. That is incredible. You think about the companies out there with Nestle, Roche, Novartis, fantastic. And, you know, just to segue into the Swiss franc, it's one of those currencies that I think if you are the kind of person to believe that US dollar dominance is in the toilet, but you don't want to bet on something like the yen or the Chinese yuan with absolutely no momentum behind it. And like, to be frank, very, very, very shoddy economies. I bet on the Swiss franc, right? And you can do that through FXF, which is the Invesco Currency Share Swiss Franc Trust. I think it's structured as a grantor trust. I'm not sure. But it, you know, unlike a lot of currency funds that hold futures or swaps, it actually holds physical, or not really physical, holds Swiss francs in a custodial trust. And it trades in US dollars. So it does earn a bit of a yield, but because the national policy rate is 0.25 and it has a 0.4 expense ratio, you're not going to get any income from it. But, you know, this is a bet on rate hikes within Switzerland, which would improve yield, or from the Swiss franc appreciating or the US dollar depreciating or both. And so I think that if you're looking for just like a way to, again, diversify your diversifiers, I wouldn't say like it's not a strategic allocation. This is not something I have for a while. But I think that if you are the kind of pessimistic person that think Europe rearming itself is going to get dragged into some broad conflict, Cold War style, this is probably the country that you can maintain some equity beta exposure to without getting destroyed. It's a very morbid thought, right? Just thinking, how do I
hedge? This is actually very good thinking.
It's interesting.
I want to hedge against it, but defense stocks are bloody expensive right now. Even when you consider the billion-dollar backlogs that the primes have, we have a volatile, unpredictable administration who's making broad sweeping cuts in various areas. Europe's rearming, but that valuation's already been driven up, right? The sector is tapped out. Defense is tapped out. The time for that trade was last year.
I love that you wrote about it because it feels to me like a real blind spot.
Yeah, nobody knows. And there's barely been any inflows, you know, but people don't realize that cheap options exist. And like, it's just another way to get your equity, another way to get your beta exposure.
And you know, as far as influence goes, the wealthiest folks in the world have their money banked there.
Sure, yeah.
And who wants to mess with that?
Nobody does.
Nobody wants. Stay away from Switzerland. Do not.
Every
look at
there's a rifle. There's a rifle every house where they had a military member. They have a national readout. Yeah. They have bunkers in the mountains. They have ways to destroy all the dams and flood the entire valley. It is nuts. Like, these people have been ready for Armageddon since World War II. Hitler eyed that and said, no, I want nothing to do with that. Stalin did the same thing. You mess with Switzerland right now and you basically ruin your country's economic standing. You know, everybody on either side of the Allied and Axis equation has assets stored there. They know that they can't touch it.
Yeah, exactly. It also is located in the middle of all mountains all around it. It's extremely hard to traverse to get there.
Yeah.
As you say, they are all prepared and they're the neutral bank, right? Everybody needs them because whoever wins the war writes the history, and the Swiss are just
need them to rebuild. That's where the fund for rebuilding will come from. It'll be from BlackRock.
Precisely.
Yeah, it'll be from UBS or something. You know, you look at, and one thing that I always look at when I do my like global macro analysis, one of the things I tend to look at is a list of countries with interest rates that are below the US. I want to see who's either winning the inflation fight or didn't even have to bother. Or maybe their economy is so in the toilet that they have no recourse but to go negative rates, you know, something like Japan. Switzerland was the only one that stood out with a robust economy, low inflation, and has been able to keep rates low for this long. But nobody thinks about a Swiss franc carry trade. Nobody borrows in Swiss francs and trades in US dollars, but they do with the yen all the time, despite the fact that the Bank of Japan is definitely not reliable. You know, you're right. It's a total blind spot right now. I'm sure there's some like CTA out there along this niche, but I haven't found them yet.
Well, you heard it. Now avert your gaze. Do not look at Switzerland.
Yeah, I don't want this place. I don't want this trade to get crowded. Actually, I've been allocating a bit myself. Just, you know, as a fingers crossed, God hopes nothing happens. But the one tail risk that I did not account for it is the fact that the ETFs holding these are in the U.S. So, you know, trade seizing on the New York Stock Exchange like it did after 9/11 would probably affect that, and we probably see a pretty significant discount to net asset value. But it is an ETF, so that would probably be quickly arbitraged away. But again, I'm saying a lot of buts here. We are really in uncharted territory right now when it comes to a lot of this, and I have never been more simultaneously optimistic for the future yet slightly disturbed by what's going on. It's an interesting time.
Kind of feel the same way.
That's why I'm moving to the middle of nowhere, by the way.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I mean, you have a number of, as much as the inflation concerns are out there and the bond vigilantes are out there, at the same time, you've got a massive deflationary wave from technology and AI. I don't know how that's going to be factored in. And yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Absolutely.
Tony, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time, your insight. It's been awesome to have you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to come on and just kind of get a sense of the zeitgeist of the advisor side.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Hope to see you guys again.
Thank you, Tony.